And she was the kind of person who put off her life for my dad, taking care of my dad while my dad was sick, and taking care of my uncle while my uncle was sick. And so that was just like Alicia. She was a very giving, selfless person.
But after surgery to remove a brain tumor, her family watched her mental health deteriorate.
For that year, she was seeking help. We were never pointed in the right direction.
And on the night of July 22nd, 2019, she grew increasingly agitated. Her family, not knowing what else to do, called 911, and sheriff's deputies arrived.
Unfortunately, that was one of the biggest mistakes that we made, because Alicia's not here today. That call resulted with my little sister, who only stood 4'11" tall with her shoes on, being shot 21 times by the men who were called to help her.
Albuquerque resident Alicia Lucero was killed by sheriff's deputies in July of 2019. The deputies were dispatched after her family called 911 for mental health crisis support. After George Floyd's murder a year and a half ago, many of the calls to reform or abolish the police are still in limbo or have been rejected outright, from reducing budgets to eliminating barriers to increasing accountability. But one area of reform is gaining traction, and that's dispatching social workers instead of armed officers for mental health-related 911 calls. According to a Washington Post database, at least a quarter of Americans shot to death by police over the last 6 years were in a mental health crisis. In September, Albuquerque became the latest city to address this violent trend by establishing a new category of first responder: behavioral health experts. After the break, we'll talk about Albuquerque's approach and take a closer look at how the movement is growing nationwide. You're listening to the 1A Podcast. I'm Jen White. Remember to join future conversations, download our 1A Vox Pop app, and leave us a voicemail. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Wyzant. Need a smarter way to learn anything? Wyzant is the nation's biggest network of professional tutors, connecting you with experts in more than 12,000 topics for personalized one-on-one lessons. On Wyzant, you choose how much to pay, who you work with, and when you meet, in person or online. NPR listeners can experience the difference personalized tutoring makes this back-to-school season by taking $25 off each of your first three lessons. Head to wyzant.com/NPR today to start learning.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're talking about Albuquerque's new category of first responders for mental health crisis calls. Joining us now to talk about it is the director of the city's new community safety department, Mariela Ruiz Angel. Mariela, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Quinn Mulhern. He's a behavioral health responder for Albuquerque's community safety department. Quinn, it's great to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I want to start with a clip of Albuquerque Mayor Tim Keller, a Democrat, from June of 2020. That's when he first announced the creation of the Community Safety Department. And here he is at a press conference.
What we found over lots of research, actually, is that there's a real need for folks who are experts in things like homelessness, behavioral health, mental health, to respond to those calls instead of police or fire.
Mariela, Albuquerque's new program is not a pilot. It's not a part of the police department. It's a separate department with a budget and a team of responders. What has it taken to get to this point?
Well, it has been a year, and talk about a journey. I will say, when this was announced, I think many of us knew it could be done, but I truly don't think that any of us knew how much work it would really take to stand up, not just a program, right? Because this was had been considered to be put into a fire department or to one of the other already existing departments. But we really wanted to create a new culture. We really wanted to create something that was going to be sustainable, that was going to be large enough to really make the impact that our city needed when it came to helping individuals with mental and behavioral health. So I will say it's been a wonderful year and lots of learning that we've had, but that time that we had to plan and that time that we were able to really curate this department has really already shown, just in the short 3 months that we've been implemented, amazing success rates.
What is the department's current budget and how do you allocate those resources?
So our current budget is about almost $8 million, and we allocate almost all of that to personnel. So it's really to get people on the streets to work with community. We also, just like any first responder model, police and fire, it requires purchasing vehicles and radios and things that, you know, help with the job. We really wanted this to be a third branch of the public safety system. And so that takes funding and money to be able to stand something up like that.
Mariella, the Albuquerque Police Department has been monitored by the federal government since 2014, when a Justice Department investigation found a pattern of unconstitutional use of force. And to clarify, your department is completely separate from Albuquerque PD. But how has the legacy of the police shaped the city's new vision for first responders?
Well, I will say the biggest thing that we can take away from our other public safety models, not just the police, but the fire department, is really that police for so long have been having to be everything for everyone. And we have to, I have to say that, like, because of that situation, we have to be, it's what is now evolving into this place where police should not have to, right? Mental health and behavioral health calls don't require a gun or a badge for every single call. And I think the history, the data, and even some of the historical, like, stories that we hear from the police officers has really helped ACS stay very true to its vision and its mission of being very separate from police, but also in collaboration so that we can step in if they are at a call that they know they're there for a police officer, or vice versa. And so I think there is this piece of the history of our police department, and even now still under the consent decree with the Department of Justice, we work very hands-on so that we can make sure that they know they're being supported and that they know that this isn't about taking all of our police calls, that this is really about sending the right response at the right time.
We reached out to Albuquerque PD to participate in the conversation, but we didn't hear back. Quinn, you're a behavioral health responder with the Community Safety Department. How did you get into this line of work?
Well, actually through social work. I changed careers kind of late in life. And after going through school and hearing a lot about, you know, police reform, a lot about, like, new models of care and social services, coming to Albuquerque and finding out that we were doing this really innovative thing. And so I applied and got the job. It was kind of an amazing once in a lifetime opportunity because I got to see really in practice, like, full bore, a lot of the values that social work has had for a long time, but haven't really been present in, like, emergency response or behavioral health response.
What is a typical, if there is such a thing, a typical day look like for you?
So usually that means clocking in at about 7 a.m. and looking through the dispatch sheets, basically, that come through police and then are filtered through the fire department. And we're dispatched to calls that are basically nonviolent, aren't going to pose a threat to us, but are still crises and really important situations that we feel we can respond to differently. So, you know, we take dozens of calls a day sometimes, and that can really vary. But I think the main thing is that we've been bringing something, I think, kind of unexpected, and people respond to that.
What is that unexpected thing you bring?
I guess it's sort of the human touch to emergency or crisis response. You know, I think police and fire, they have their priorities, which are very worthy and very important, you know, like public safety or maybe an emergent medical situation. But, you know, they aren't always equipped sort of because of that. They aren't always equipped to make that human connection. So when things aren't a medical crisis or aren't a public safety issue, they don't always have those tools. But because we do, people often really respond to that and recognize that we're trying something different, and they're often very positive with us as a result.
Mariela, walk us through how this crisis response system works. So let's say someone calls 911 because a friend is having a mental health emergency. How does the dispatcher decide what type of first responder to contact?
Well, really, it's three things. If there is not a emergent medical need, like something that's very clear from, you know, someone bleeding, if there is not a visual weapon, like somebody, there's a gun that someone says, you know, they have a weapon. And the third is if it's not a violent call, it's already not escalated to a point where it would require some sort of restraint. And even those, some of those are fuzzy because sometimes it's just a bystander, right, cruising down the street and sees somebody and they need help, so they don't really have the full story. So although, you know, we would go to something, we would never go to a domestic violence call. We have, because somebody thought it was somebody who might be unsheltered. And when we got there, it was actually a much escalated situation. And we handle those situations very well, actually. So we know that there is a variety of calls that we can take. So dispatch will qualify the call, the 911 dispatch will, and then it gets sent to our fire alarm room, in which they actually will connect with the responder, our behavioral health responders, to send them out. And so we have about five teams now, teams of two, who will take these calls through the same CAD systems, the same radios as police and fire. And so we really are integrated into the true 911 system.
According to FBI data, Albuquerque had the ninth highest rate of violent crime in the country in 2019. For context, it's the 32nd most populous city in the country. In an interview with the Washington Post, Sean Willoughby, he's a police detective and the president of the Albuquerque Officers Union, said, quote, "We worry for these clinicians. It's all fun and games until you get on scene and someone is wanting to fight." Quinn, we know that the presence of police can contribute to escalation, but putting that aside, what's your response to those concerns? How concerned are you about your own safety when you're responding to these calls?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we have had some training, mostly about personal awareness of situations. And that's really what it's come down to. There have been a few situations where we just kind of got a sense, you know, a gut feeling or looked over the scene and it just didn't seem safe for us. But those are very few and far between, surprisingly. And Albuquerque has a reputation for being a violent city. In certain ways, that's true. But when we actually make contact with people, we often see their demeanor shift, even if they were somewhat hostile or defensive. When they figure out who we are and what we're there for, things really change. I've never felt in danger in this job. And I don't think that's just naivete or something. We actually are very aware of what's going on around us. But to be quite honest, people, you know, soften quite a bit when they understand what we're doing. And I think that really has made all the difference. Having some situational awareness for sure, but, you know, not ultimately taking the bait of trying to look at somebody as a threat immediately changes the way that they react to you. And it sounds hokey or something, but that is really the case. When we've approached people with a different attitude, kind of an open hand, people tend to respond in kind to us.
Well, so when you get that gut feeling that this situation is unsafe, what happens next? How do you respond?
So as I said, that has happened very few times, but we'll often just reconnect with police. In certain situations, it's more of a medical situation, so we'll connect with fire and rescue. So in those situations, we simply call in and re-explain the situation and what's happening. But as I said, that happens so rarely, it barely comes up.
Advocates for increased mental health care say jails and prisons have become the country's de facto mental health care providers. Mariella, how are you hoping to change outcomes for those struggling with mental health problems or substance abuse when there is a limit to the resources you can point people to?
Well, one, I think that having alternative responses and ACS in general, I think is really going to help be a catalyst. One, the data that we're collecting, and two, just like Lynn said, the connectivity that we're getting with community is super powerful because we're hearing the stories, we're understanding the struggles, so that it's not just about, right, I just need to get on the housing list. It's, I can't sustain housing, right, because of XYZ. And so I think that's going to really help as we think about long-term outcomes of individuals, how we can better the system as a community. But additionally, my hope is that ACS can also work collaboratively with those nonprofits who are, you know, struggling with funding or struggling with capacity to really say, how do we as a community ask for additional federal funds, right? How do we, many of the federal funding that we see for public safety is very black and white. It's police and fire or security, right? They don't always include mobile crisis teams. And that's got to be from a federal level. We have to start including alternative types of responses so that we can have a chance to grow as police officers, right? Our 7.7, although people, right, it is quite a bit of money, but it's nothing compared to the $230 million that the police departments or more that other cities get. So it's definitely just similar to what Quinn is saying. Is we hope to be a catalyst in this in this new arena that we're in, but it is going to take a village, and we have money that fortunately we've been able to utilize to help bolster some of those nonprofits who are using heavily for services. But this is a nationwide issue. This can't be fixed with just a couple $100,000.
That's Mariella Ruiz Angel. She's the director of Albuquerque's Community Safety Department. Also with us was Quinn Mulhern. He's a behavioral health responder for Albuquerque's Community Safety Department. Mariella, Quinn, thanks for speaking with us. Coming up, we'll zoom out and talk about the growing movement to dispatch social workers for mental health crises nationwide. We'll get back to our conversation about first responders and mental health crisis calls. And a reminder to have your questions answered on future topics or just to let us know what you think, tweet us at 1A. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Grifols. Senior Director of Corporate Affairs Vlasta Hakes explains the science behind the plasma-derived medicines the company produces.
Plasma contains proteins and antibodies. There are people who are missing those antibodies or they're missing a protein that helps their body function. And what Grifols then does is we collect this plasma and then isolate those proteins and antibodies to produce a medicine.
To learn more about donating plasma and to find a Grifols center near you, visit grifolsplasma.com.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Now let's get back to our conversation about first responders and mental health crisis calls. Mizuno tweeted, I'll say this, when I wasn't exactly in crisis and a friend called 911, it was state police that came to my house and forced me to go to the hospital, which put me under a lot more stress and anxiety. And Wesley wrote on Facebook, I'm a behavioral health clinician who has interacted several times with law enforcement and people in crisis, and finding an alternative to having appropriately trained specialists deal with these kinds of calls is very bad. Badly needed. Let's turn now to Alex Vitale. He's a professor and the coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. He's also the author of The End of Policing. Professor Vitale, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jen.
Well, I want to start by getting your reaction to Albuquerque's new Community Safety Department and what we heard from Mariella and Quinn before the break.
Well, I think this is part of a really encouraging national trend that actually began before the horrible George Floyd killing, but has really accelerated since then. And I think while it is, as your guest pointed out, it's just a beginning. I think it's really important for establishing a kind of new way of thinking about public safety that's more holistic and isn't rooted in this idea that police are the only possible tool we can use to keep people safe.
Before the police killing of George Floyd, how were cities around the country thinking about their response to mental health crisis calls?
Well, as you mentioned in the earlier part of the segment, this is a huge problem, both in terms of the massive volume of calls and in the number of deaths. You know, it's at least a quarter of all police killings involve someone having a mental health crisis, and some estimates are as high as 50%. Here in New York City, where I live, the NYPD goes on over 200,000 of these calls every year. And while most of them are resolved without any kind of horrible outcome, the outcomes are not particularly good either. And so this has become a huge part of what police do on an everyday basis. I think the police themselves are deeply frustrated about the lack of resources that they have to adequately handle these calls. And so it's pretty clear that a radical new approach is needed.
Well, Albuquerque is one of the latest examples of this shift toward behavioral health first responders, but they're not the first city to try this approach. What other programs have we seen around the country over the last few years?
Well, one of the best known and longest existing programs is the CAHOOTS program, C-A-H-O-O-T, which is in Oregon around the city of Eugene and some surrounding areas. And they've been around actually for 30 years, and they're integrated into the 911 system there. And they actually handle 20% of all 911 calls. And I know one of your earlier commenters was concerned about, you know, the well-being and safety of the responders, but this has just turned out not to be a concern there in Oregon. In 24,000 calls in a year, they only requested police assistance 150 times. That's less than 1%. And it didn't involve any harm to the outreach workers. They're available 24/7 and handle a mix of mental health, substance abuse, homelessness-related crises. Another program that's been up and running for a shorter period of time is the STARS program in Denver. And in their first 6 months of operation, they went on almost 2,000 calls and didn't request police assistance a single time. So I think this idea that we must have an armed response to these calls just doesn't hold up to the empirical realities we're seeing.
How are these departments measuring success?
That's a great question. I think there's a couple ways to measure success here. One is, you know, reducing the amount of violence. And that's one of the things these programs have really been able to do. I think the other measure of success is saving money. It turns out that in Oregon, the CAHOOTS program, they estimate is saving the counties there about $10 million a year because it's cheaper to send outreach workers and to divert people from emergency rooms and police lockups than it is to send police. And I think another measure of success should be the degree to which we actually work to resolve people's underlying problems. Are we reducing their homelessness? Are we stabilizing their mental health situation? Are we stabilizing their harmful substance abuse behaviors? And I think that's the area where we have a lot more work to do.
Right, because if we're thinking about diverting people to resources that can help address that underlying problem, that requires there to be a network of services that are actually in place, sufficient services to meet the needs of a given community. And are we actually seeing that in place?
Well, we're not. And I think Albuquerque, unfortunately, is a good example of this. While we're reducing those interactions between police and the public that can be so fraught, we're not really doing anything about the underlying problem there. And, you know, in Albuquerque, a majority of the calls actually involve, you know, responding to people who are homeless, helping to manage complaints about homeless encampments. And it really becomes a kind of unfortunate whack-a-mole situation where people are simply pushed from one place to the next with their homelessness never really being addressed, or more, even less so, their mental health instability. And so we've got a lot of work to do to increase the capacity of local governments to fundamentally address these problems and not just to put a less kind of violent band-aid over it.
Broadly speaking, how have police forces and unions responded to this shift in mental health crisis response?
Well, somewhat unevenly. On the one hand, we do routinely hear from police that they don't like going on these calls. They're frustrated about them. They wish someone would take them off their hands. But then we also hear, especially from the police unions, well, these calls are so incredibly dangerous, we can't possibly send unarmed social workers into the jaws of death. And this is clearly exaggerated and self-serving and not true. We have enough concrete on-the-ground evidence to know that this just is not true, that we can send social workers who are properly trained to manage the vast majority of these calls without the risk of violence.
Professor Vitale, how often are we seeing these being separate departments, separate from the police department, separate from the fire department? And how often are we seeing models that are more partnerships with police departments?
Yeah, we call that latter a kind of co-response model. And Tennessee was a place where there was a tremendous amount of innovation there, creating what we call CIT programs or crisis intervention training that partner police with social workers. And that's what Albuquerque had for a number of years as well. And unfortunately, while those programs at times anecdotally, you know, people feel better about them, they have not changed the overall dynamic. They have not dramatically or even significantly reduced the number of police killings, and they've not addressed this metric of getting people real assistance to their underlying problems. The reality is that the presence of an armed police officer in the majority of these counters is destabilizing, and it causes people to be defensive, to not want to engage, and it just doesn't lead to good outcomes. And that's why what we see now is a growing number of cities looking for completely police-free responses.
In the cities that have rethought how they respond to mental health crises, what's the difference between a community-based approach like Albuquerque is taking and a more maybe centralized approach that may focus on, say, EMTs?
Well, I wouldn't exactly say that Albuquerque is taking a community-based approach. Their approach is, you know, run through fire and EMS. It's controlled centrally. They've created a kind of mental health crisis oversight board, but that board is made up entirely of city-funded programs and service providers. And I think what we're hearing from peer advocates across the country is that what we need is more peer-to-peer interventions, more interventions that are also overseen by independent community-based groups and peer-led organizations. So that means groups that are not reliant on city resources so that they can speak clearly about what the community needs, even if it doesn't mesh exactly with the political priorities of the city's leadership. And this is a concern in Albuquerque that we're hearing from some peer groups on the ground that too often the dispatches are just in the service of clearing out an encampment or dealing with a chronic problem by just moving the problem somewhere else, despite the best intentions of the outreach workers.
But some of that is also due to a lack of resources in Albuquerque, right? If there's no place to send someone, if their resources aren't there, that safety net isn't there to catch them, then what options do these responders really have?
This is entirely correct. But even there, you know, there are peer-to-peer resources in Albuquerque that exist that could be significantly expanded, and they need resources to do that, but they also need to be involved in the planning of and oversight of these programs.
When we talk about the funding of programs like this, we heard from Mariella earlier that there's a need for more federal funds to go into these programs. How are different cities and communities handling the price tag piece of this?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind something that that your guest Quinn kind of pointed out, which is that there has been a systematic defunding of community-based mental health services beginning all the way back in the Kennedy administration, when he began to dismantle the deeply problematic state hospital systems across the country. And part of what was promised at that time, and this occurred similarly on a kind of state-by-state basis through the 70s and 80s, was that the spending for the state hospitals would be redirected to community-based resources to allow people to live more independently with some dignity. But those community-based resources never materialized. And so that is like the number one explanation of why we have this massive level of untreated mental health crisis calls in the country, is because we do not have any viable community-based mental health infrastructure. And financial responsibility for that is going to have to come from not just local cities, but also the state and federal level.
And thinking back to Mariella and Quinn's conversation and in talking to you now, it sounds to me as if we're trying to address one puzzle piece in a larger puzzle. And I'm curious how you think we can move to a more holistic approach, that we address all of the issues that are in play when we look at people who need support in dealing with substance abuse, who need mental health care support. How do we just shift the way we approach this issue altogether?
Well, I think, as I said before, right, one of the things that's exciting about these programs is it is trying to establish a kind of new logic about how we think about public safety. But I think what's missing is there needs to be a much stronger voice from the community in how we conceptualize these things, so that as we create alternative public safety departments, community safety departments across the country, we need to really ramp up the role for communities so that they can talk concretely about the kinds of investments and programmatic interventions that they think are needed to produce real safety for themselves. And this is not going to be limited to, you know, replacing one type of police response with social workers. It's got to be about addressing these underlying, you know, deep inequalities that so many parts of our society are experiencing right now.
That's Alex Vitale. He's a professor and the coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. He's also the author of The End of Policing. Professor Vitale, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Jen.
Today's producer was Catherine Fink. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk more soon. This is 1A.